Okay, friends, we find ourselves on Chav Ches Amid Aleph 28A. Let's see, we are a little bit of the way down, actually. We are at Shalu Talmidav es Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana. So, just to reorient ourselves, this will be taking up most of what we're going to be doing this evening. The Gemara, basically, I'm not going to explain again how it segued, but just take my word for it. Last week, we segued into basically asking different sages why they think that they merited to live a long life. And each one of them shares generally, three to four different things that they were conscientious about, and we have what to learn from them. So that's going to take up most of what we're going to do tonight. However, at the end, toward the end, we're going to get, God willing, to the next Mishnah, all the way on the bottom of the Amud, in which we're going to start talking about what is someone allowed to do and not allowed to do in a Beis HaKnesses. It's almost a little bit out of order conceptually, because we're talking about selling a Beis HaKnesses, and then what can you do afterwards? We're going to talk about what if a Beis HaKnesses doesn't get sold, what is one permitted and not permitted to do? And then, God willing, there should be time for this, I believe. There was this sefer, there's a journal called Hadarim Journal, and they put out a special volume in honor of Gedaliah Dov Schwartz, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, who was the Av Beis Din of the CRC in Chicago, where Henry is. So this just came out. It was sent to every member of the Rabbinical Council of America, and there is a tshuva in here in which he is asked a question about conducting a funeral inside a Beis HaKnesses, which is very relevant for what we're going to be talking about toward the end of this year tonight, God willing, and also very relevant, actually, I think, for our own minhagim here at Agudath Shalom, in which we rarely have funeral services in the sanctuary. They're generally in the chapel. So we'll talk about that toward the end, God willing. So anyway, just for those joining us right now, not to worry, I was just giving words of introduction. We're about to jump into the Gemara. Again, 28a, Chav Ches Amid Aleph. We are at Shalu Talmidus Rabbi Nechunya, a little bit the way down. I assume in the art scroll, they probably make a new paragraph over there. Okay. Are we still on the first page in the art scroll for those who are on there just to help our friends? Yes, Henry, we got the thumbs up. Here we go. Shalu Talmidim Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana. B'ma heirachta yamim. What did you do that you merited to live a long life? I never gathered honor for myself by the downfall, by the degradation of another person. And basically what this means is that when I will go to sleep, I would make sure to forgive those who had caused me distress during the day. And I was, I don't know what the right word for vatran in this context is, but I was forgiving about my money. I wasn't nickeling and diming people. We'll see precisely what that means soon. It's interesting. I follow sometimes as a fellow named Rabbi Gill student. He runs Torah Musings, which I publish on sometimes. So he pointed out actually an interesting contrast. We learned recently in recent parshiyos how Yaakov Avinu, he goes back for the pachim ketanim, for the small little jugs. So if you want to look at it cynically, like, oh, the Jews, they want all to keep all their money. They'll go back even for those little pots. It's interesting to contrast that with the idea of being a vatran when it comes to your mamon and not looking at every last little dime and being forgiving in that regard. So maybe the difference is being a vatran when giving money to others versus making sure not to lose the assets that God blessed you with. Okay, just a little footnote over here. Lo niskabati b'kol chaver. So let's break it down. What does it mean that I would never save and salvage my own honor at the expense of someone else's? So a case that brings this, not a case, but more like an anecdote that brings out this idea. Ki hadra funa dori mora akaspe. Rav Huna was carrying a shovel on his shoulder, Osirav Chana Bar Chanilai v'kadori minay. Then came along Rav Chana Bar Chanilai, and he takes the shovel, he takes the spade from him, and he says, I'm going to hold it instead. I'll help you out. Apparently, carrying such a shovel was not considered the most dignified activity. Amarle, iragalisa de doris b'maseich, dari. If you normally carry a shovel around with you where you live, and you're accustomed to doing that, by all means, thank you for the help. Below, isyakure anab is ilusa didach lo nichali. However, if you don't normally carry this around, and this could be seen as undignified, I'm not going to salvage my own dignity by having you compromise your dignity. So that's what it means. We shouldn't salvage our own dignity by compromising others. Next. Right? What does it mean? I didn't come upon my bed with the curse of my fellow. When Marzutra would go to bed, he would, before going to sleep, I'm sure he said Hamako also, he would forgive everyone who caused him distress during the day. Now, there's an interesting question to be raised. Maybe it's a difference between Ditsaran versus, you know, there's things that people do that can annoy you, you know, like maybe that guy was scraping something and was making noise, or they were clicking too hard on their keyboard next to you where you're working in the office space. So, you know, maybe that's something. I mean, there's obviously things people can do that require them to be mevakish mechila, to seek forgiveness. I think we all know intuitively, hopefully not too much from experience, there's different gradations of what people can do to cause another person distress. I imagine this is referring to more, you know, common issues, not to someone who did something very malicious or offensive. But I'm sure, I didn't look at the Mefarshim on this, I'm sure there's different deos how to read. You know, maybe he was just that kind of guy who was really forgiving of everything. Okay. Guvatra Bimoni, what's it mean that he was very forgiving about his personal assets? Vatra Bimoni Hayisi, Damar Mar, Io Vatram Bimone, Hava Shohem Maniach Kuta Lechemini Bimone. Eov was a vatra when it came to this money. What does it mean? So, you know, when you, I guess it's kind of a modern day example of it. Well, let's say you're at the cashier and the cashier is going to give you like a few cents back. So you can say, keep the change. Or, you know, sometimes they say, would you like to round up so we can donate to this charity over here? So apparently he was that guy who clicked on rounding up to give to the charity at the checkout at Stop and Shop. So that's that was his particular mitzvah. Okay, so that's all Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana. We just, and this is kind of like the theme, like he first tells us what his special hakpados, his special things that he was careful about, and then we kind of break down what that means. Next, Shol Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Nechunya HaGadol. It would seem that Rabbi Nechunya HaGadol is the same person, just he was called Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana when he was starting off his rabbinic career, and then once he became very prestigious, then apparently people call him Rabbi Nechunya HaGadol, the great Rabbi Nechunya. It seems most assume this is the same person as before, which is interesting because it would mean that when he got asked the question, what did you do to merit to live a long life? Apparently at an even later stage in his life, he had a slightly different answer for what those midos were. Just interesting to note if we assume that he's the same person. So Amar lo b'maharachta yamim. So he said, so first, this is, before we get to the answer, Rabbi Akiva says, what did you do to live such a long life? Now, this is important. If you write this down and you email to someone and there's no intonation, it can be read two ways. It can be, wow, what did you do to live such a long life, Rabbi Nechunya? The other way to read it is, geez, what did you do to live such a long life? When are we going to get rid of you already? So apparently, these Gavazi of a so who are these folks? Rashi tells us, these were basically his servants. His servants heard this and they thought that Rabbi Akiva was slighting him, saying, when are you going to die already? Why are you living such a long life? So they then accosted Rabbi Akiva. Saw Yosef HaRishon the Dikla. Rabbi Akiva escapes and he climbs up a palm tree, and they're all at the bottom trying to climb up to get him. And then Rabbi Akiva says, "Amarle Rebbe," he asks him a shaila. Nemar keves keves lama nemar echad. If it already says when talking about, I believe the Karban Tamid, it's talking about how you bring that one sheep. If it says sheep in the singular, why did the Torah need to say the word echad also? So Amar Lahu, when Rabbi Nechunya heard him ask this incisive question about the Torah, he says, shapkuvo. We see that he is a Torah scholar. Clearly, he wasn't trying to slight me. He was asking genuinely to understand why I lived a long life. So Rabbi Akiva had to prove his credentials that he was actually a Torah scholar who maybe could have asked it in a more tactful way. But so anyway, Amarle, first of all, he answers the immediate question. What's the word Echad teach us? That when you bring that lamb, you bring the sheep to God, it should be the choicest of the flock. Anyway, now that Rabbi Akiva has proven his credentials, Rabbi Nechunya is going to answer his original question, which is, why did Rabbi Nechunya merit to live such a long life? So, Amarle, by the way, just one little ha'ara, I just noticed this. I'll share with you. Maybe the article footnotes point this out. I have no idea. You could tell me. When he says Amarlut, Surbamidur, he's, one of the members of our, young members of the rabbinate here. Leave him alone. You actually see that in different Gemaras where something similar happens. If you remember, this is actually relevant for Purim, which is coming up. Remember last year, Purim time, we did that shiur on cross-dressing on the Yilvash? So if you remember, there's a Gemara in which they started giving lashes to somebody. And when they uncovered the halachos, we learned this in Makos when we did Makos last year, is that they actually take the shirt off in order so that they can whip him directly. So nothing interposes between the whip and the person's body. And when they saw that he had armpit hair, they said, leave him. He is clearly, I'm not sure if it's Surah or Rabbanah, but it says that he was a conscientious person, and therefore they didn't give him lashes. Now, what the heck does armpit hair have to do with anything? In that sugya, we're talking about how men are not supposed to razor off hair from their body because that's a breach of masculinity. That's considered grooming like a woman. And we're not going to go down that rabbit hole right now, but there's a similar instance where they're hitting somebody, they're whacking him, and they're like, wait, oh, he's a Talmud Chacham, leave him alone. So, if only that's how it worked nowadays. Nowadays, it's he's a Talmud Chacham, get him, So, all right, there was some benefits back in the day. Anyway, going forward in the Gemara, Amarle. So here's our answer finally. Mi amai, Loki Balti Matanos. Number one, what was Rabbi Nechunya Gadol? What did he do that gave him a long life? He did not accept gifts. That's very important. We'll talk about soon why that's the case. Amidosai. We'll talk about what that means also. Uvat Brumoni. And again, same thing we saw before, that I wasn't particular about the money. I rounded up at the cash register. So let's break it down. Loki balti matanos. I did not accept gifts. So where do we see such an idea? In a story where Rav Elazar was given gifts from the house of the Nasi, from the house of the political authority in charge of the Jews. He did not want to accept those gifts. And when he was invited to join them for a meal, lo hava azal, he wouldn't go. Why? Amarlo, he said to them, lo nichaluchu de'echia, do you not want me to live? After all, the siv, it says in Mishlei, soni matanos yichia, he who despises gifts shall live. Now, why should he despise gifts? So it might be a general statement not to become reliant on others, but I think the reason that Rav Elazar was particularly careful about this was, again, he was being sent to this by the Nasi, and the Nasi was probably trying to ingratiate himself with members of the rabbinate. It's like, I remember one time, someone did me a favor, and then he's like, Rabbi, next time I need a heter, just remember this. So it's important. You don't want to get bribery. You don't want to get bribed by people. So Rebbe Elazar was very careful about that. I'm very appreciative. Anyone who does this kindness, by the way, I do that. I'm very thankful for that. I'm just pointing it out. Just a little humor. Rav Zeira, ki hava mishadri le mi bein asiyah, lo hava shakyal, ki hava mizani le ozel. However, there's a similar instance where Rav Zeira was offered a gift. He declined the gift, similar to Rav Elazar, but when he was invited over for a meal by the Nasi's house, then he did go. Why? Amar isyakuri de miskairi. They are being honored by my presence. Meaning, I don't know, my wife makes a good challenge. I don't need to go to this guy's house. Why am I going? They are honored by my presence that I'm coming. By the way, this is similar. I think we talked about this 1 week or 2 weeks ago, perhaps. We're talking about the case in Kiddushin, in which generally the way a man betroths a woman is he gives her the ring, he gives her something of value of a Sheva Pruta, and then she in return gives herself over to him. However, there's a really funny case where the woman actually gives something to the man, and what's the man giving to her in return? What's he giving to her to get her? He's giving her the satisfaction of giving a gift to such a prestigious individual. So you got to think really highly of yourself for that, apparently. I know she should be marrying a guy who thinks that way. But anyway, I'm not one of those rabbis that gives marital advice, so I'll just leave it there. Okay. So that's so then finally, let's just wrap this up. Anyone who's able to overcome his own midos, his own grudges that he has against other people, God will reciprocate. To whom is God going to forgive his iniquity? To those who are able to overcome and to pass over and forgive the slights that they received from others. And it makes sense. If we could be forgiving of others, God will reciprocate and he too can be forgiving of us as well. Again, I think there's a little bit between the lines over here. Someone wrongs another person, remember, part of tshuva is they have to do mechila. They still have to ask for forgiveness themselves and they have to make amends. So I don't want us to think just that we shouldn't, there's sometimes bad things that are done in the world, but being open to reconciliation is definitely a value I think that's being conveyed here. Okay, next. Next rabbi. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, what did you do to live until a ripe old age? Amarle, Katsubachayai, are you upset that I am still alive? Again, people are really taking this the wrong way. I'm not really sure why. I mean, I guess he texted it to him. He didn't hear the intonation. But do you not want me to live longer? Are you upset that I live so long? Amarlo, no, Rebbe, that's not what I meant. Torah hi olamot ani tzarich. Another important Talmudic phrase you'll see sometimes comes up in brachos also. Rebbe, I'm not trying to snoop into your personal affairs. It just apparently you're doing something right. And I want to learn from your righteous ways. Samarle, I accept that. Okay, I'll answer your question. Mi amai, lo nistakhalti b'dmus adam rasha. What was the special thing that I was very careful and conscientious about? I would not gaze at the visage of a wicked person. Well, I bet Arsenal used the word visage. Do they? I want to get points for this. What do they say? Lotus the county with the Musa Adam Rasha, and not gaze at the visage of a wicked person.
Yeah, it's just translated at the, as the face.
Oh, see, I outdid art scroll now, but I'm very proud of myself. Okay, so I must have gotten it from Edgar Allan Poe. Dama Rav Yochanan, Aster la Adam listakvet sam to Musa Adam Rasha. A person not supposed to stare at the image of a wicked person. Shenamar, where do we see this? So basically what happens is, in my very limited knowledge of Sefer Malachim, what basically happens is that the kingdoms of Yisrael, of Israel, and Judah, they team up in order to fight a common foe, to fight the king of Moab. And however, while Yehoshaphat's a very nice guy, the other king, whom I am forgetting offhand, if someone wants to remind me, who are not people. Who was the king of Israel at that time? Okay, someone remind me. But
you learned today. Didn't we talk about that this morning?
Oh, I mean, there were different Yerovam ben Nevat, but I don't think it was Yerovam. Yeah. I don't think it was Yerovam at the time. Whoever was at the same time as Yehoshaphat, someone let me know. It is Malachim Beis Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud Aleph.
Malachim Beis Perek.
All right. Well, while Henry's looking up the precise name, I'll just tell you what's going on here. So Elisha says, if I didn't respect Yehoshaphat, I wouldn't be. So Yehoshaphat wants to seek advice from Elisha in order to be successful. But then Elisha sees that Yehoshaphat is with this wicked king of Israel. And Elisha says, if I didn't respect Yehoshaphat so much, I would not be here right now because I would not even want to look at your face. And what we see over here is that one is not supposed to look at the face of a wicked person.
The other king is Yehoram.
Yehoram, yeah. Okay, thank you.
You beat me to it. Yehoram ben Acha.
Okay. Oh, you see, totally.
Go to the art scroll.
Okay. All right, very good. So there we are. Same principle. Thank you, guys. Rabbi Elazar Amar Einav Kehos. Shenemar, not only are you not supposed to stare at a Russia, but apparently your eyes will weaken as well. You know, it's kind of funny. Remember we talked about a number of weeks ago, we're talking about the blessing of Kohanim, Birchus Kohanim. And we said back in the day when it was done in the Beis HaMikdash, and the Kohanim invoked the Shem HaMefurash, that secret name of God. So if anyone was looking at them while the Shekhinah was resting on their hands, then your eyes would weaken, right? So as a kid always, I imagine at shul, it's like, you know, you think that's like Lot's wife when they're leaving Sodom. That if you look back, you like turn to stone or something's going to happen to you if you look at the Kohanim during Birchas Kohanim. You know, they are covering their hands with talis as well. That's what they should be doing. So they, back in the day, in the Beis HaMikdash, when the actual presence of God supposedly rested on their hands, it actually would weaken one's eyesight if they look. Similar idea, but for opposite reasons over here. If one looks at the visage of a Russia, then they too will have weakened eyesight. And where do we see this idea? Shenemar vayhi ki zakan Yitzchak v'tichahena inav meros mishum de'as mishum istak v'esav v'Russia. Why did Yitzchak's eyes begin to weaken? Because he was gazing at his wicked son Esav. Hagar Malay? Was Yitzchak responsible for his loss of eyesight? By the way, right? That's how the whole story with Yaakov stealing the brachos happens. Because again, Yitzchak becomes blind. So
they said it was because of the Akedah.
So it's not shot here in the Gemara, but maybe that's a possibility. But if you hear, so Va'amar Rav Yitzchak, Lo Olam Alti Kilas Hed Yokal Beinecha, the curse of even someone of a simple person should not be taken lightly in your eyes. Because Avimelech curses Sarah, and the curse took effect on her child Yitzchak. Shenemar, Hinehu lecha, or Zalach, or Lach, Kesus Einayim. So Kesus Einayim is understood as clothing of the eyes, which could be translated as clothing that is pleasing for the eyes to see. So that sounds like he's giving her something of benefit. But actually, altikri kisus elekisias einayim, not clothing of the eyes, but a covering of the eyes. So he was cursing her, and for some reason it didn't affect her, but affected her child Yitzchak, that he lost his eyesight, as if his eyes were covered. So the question is, well, is it because Yitzchak was staring at a Russia, or because Sarah, his mother, was cursed?
Oh. But by the way, there is a Medrash that supports what Gloria said about the tears. There's several different...
The smoke from the Avodah Zarah, you're saying?
From the Avodah Zarah, and also when the Malachim wept during the Akedah, that the tears fell into his eyes or something.
Oh, interesting. The smoke went out.
There's several different midrashim on what happened there.
That's what I think Rashi mentioned that.
Oh, wait, Rashi here? Or the Akedah?
Rashi on Chumash brings that under Medrash. Yeah.
Okay, So that's an interesting point, that this Gemara is either not aware of, for some reason doesn't invoke it. All right, very good. The answer is Hava HaGarmale. They're all true. They're all good reasons to accept all of them. Why not? Just a reminder to meet ourselves, please, just as some background music. Background music. One second, I'll do it. Sounds very tasty. Okay. All right, let's go. Rava Amar Mehacha says Pnei Rasha Loto. Well, Rava's like, I got a better pasuk for you. It says in the verse that looking at that the face of a Rasha is no good. So there you go. That's pretty black on white. Moving forward. The Shas Piti Raso. So again, just the conversation over here was between Rebbe and Rebbe Shua ben Karcha. So Rebbe Shua ben Karcha was on his deathbed. He was passing away. Amar le Rebbe Barcheni. So Rebbe says, please bless me before you leave this world. Amar le, he says, Yiratsu shetagia lechetzi yamai. I bless you that you should live up to half of the length of my days. Cool. Oh, wait, you don't want me to, wait a minute, I ask you for a blessing, not a curse. You only want me to live up to half the amount of days that you lived? Amar lo, the reason is, haboy machrecha behema yir. Because the people after you, your descendants will just be sheep herders. What is that supposed to mean? What it means is that so long as you are still here and you're running the family business and you're basically taking care of the entire family and you are the main figure, you're never going to give your descendants the chance to be able to grow into their own people as well. And so his blessing was that you should leave this world at a natural time. That way your children, after hopefully being raised by you, they'll be able to grow independently as well, and they won't have to depend on you throughout all those days. It gives you a lot to think about. I don't have any particularly profound insight into it, but it gives you a lot to think about. So otherwise, they'll just be animal herders. They'll just cruise on through life, and they'll live off all of your work. Okay. Next. Avu bar ihi umin yamin bar ihi chan amar tesi li tovis talki v'goy. Similar idea. There were these two righteous people. One said, God will reward me because I never gazed at a non-Jew. V'chan amar tesi li tolo avdi shutfas bahadi goy. And the other one says, God should give me a reward because I never entered into a partnership with a non-Jew. Again, doesn't mean non-Jew literally. Doesn't mean pagans. Many times when we're referencing non-Jews in the Talmud, referring to specifically pagan worshippers, if that makes you feel more comfortable, you are in good hands. There are those who reinterpret it that way. So if it makes you feel better, you can go with that shot. Shalom Talmidavis Rabbi Zera. By the way, that answer only works for us in Western countries. Like in Eastern countries, they're still worshiping full out of Avodah Zarah. So even that answer might not make you feel too happy if we were living in the East. Rabbi Zer, but Yamin. Finally, they asked Rabbi Zer, what did you do to merit to live a long life? I was never overly mocked in my household. I didn't raise my voice frequently. I tried to maintain shalom bias. I didn't stride before those who are greater than me. I didn't go in front of them. And I didn't think about Torah while I was going down an alleyway, which has excrement or something that clean in there. And when I was in clean places, I would never walk more than 4 amos without thinking in Torah and without wearing tefillin. And I would never take a nap in the base medrash. Not an established nap, and not even Ishina Sarai, not even a quick hour nap, which for a Talmud Chacham who learns in Beis Medrash technically is allowed to do that. I remember in Shalavim, it's not just Shalavim, by the way, it's like a lot of captive programs, in which you kind of like have early chakras. Actually, it's kind of funny now that I look back. Chakras back then seemed so early to me. It was like at 7:10 in the morning. Now I'd give anything for it. I go to 6:30 showers. So it's amazing how things change in different stages of life. But the day then ends at like 10 o'clock, and then sometimes they have VOD, which people go to 11 o'clock. I don't have people function. So you like come in the morning. Supposedly there was halacha seder for about 20 minutes or so before regular morning studies began. And you just see like a whole, I took a photo. One time there was like a whole row of people, just like with their heads down on the table and their sweatshirt hoodies over them, all taking power naps in order so that they can make it through a 3-hour morning seder. So anyway, you're not supposed to take a nap in the basement, not an established nap. If you need to, you can take a power nap. This rabbi was so special, he didn't even take power naps inside the base medrash. Maybe because he had a healthy sleeping schedule. Maybe that was it. I never rejoiced over the downfall of my fellow man. And I wouldn't call somebody by his nickname, or the other understanding is not by a pejorative name for his family's name. And that brings us to the Mishnah on the Baal Chakas Amar Av. Let me pause for a moment. I know none of this would, or almost none of this was of a halakhic nature, so I don't know if we have any particularly intricate questions, but if there's anything or any thoughts that cross your mind that you briefly want to share before we proceed to the next Mishnah, please do so at this time. All right, I waited till Kadei Dibor. We get to go on to the next Mishnah. Here we go. This next Mishnah is very halakhic and very lamaisa, and we'll only begin to put our toes into the water right now and get our feet wet, but we'll delve hopefully further deeper into this next week. Here we go. Va'odam Rabbi Yehuda. This Mishnah, by the way, is a continuation of the previous Mishnah. The previous Mishnah ended off with Rabbi Yehuda making a statement, so this Mishnah continues with, and Rabbi Yehuda said furthermore, Beis HaKnesses Shecharav Ein Maspidin B'socho, that a Beis HaKnesses that is destroyed, we do not eulogize in it. The Ein Mafshilim B'socho Chavalim, we don't hang up the ropes in there. Bein Porsin L'socho Metsudos, we don't lay traps for animals in there. Bein Shotkin Al Gago Peros, we don't make dried fruit on the roof of the building. Bein Osin L'socho Kapandria, and we cannot use it either as a shortcut. Shene'emar, and I will make barren your sanctified places. What we can infer from the verse is Kiddushasan Afkishen Shomen, that a shul, sanctified ground, even if it is barren, even if no one's showing up for minyan, no one's showing up to shul anymore, it still remains sanctified. Alabo Asabim, and if grass begins to grow through the cracks, Lo Yitlo shows, Lo Yitlosh, you may not trim the grass. Why? Yipnei Agmas Nefesh, because people should feel, they should feel anguish and distress when they see the shul is not being used. In other words, the shul is not meant to just be a nice little museum that's nice and polished, that people can come in every now and then. I know I'm preaching to the choir over here. That people come in and see every now and then. And if that is the case, you should actually let the grass grow in there. And when people walk by and they'll ask, wait, why is there grass going through the cracks? Why is this not maintained? The answer will be, well, because no one uses the shul, and that's why it's not being maintained. Ashrenu, we use our shul, so we don't have this issue. But all the things that are mentioned here in this Mishnah is a Kal V'Chomer. These are things that you can't do even when the Beis HaKnesses is not in operation. Kal v'chomer, anything mentioned in the Mishnah cannot be done when the Beis HaKnesses is in operation. Paul.
Yeah, going to the Mishnah, it seems like there's an appreciable difference between eulogizing and then all those more mundane, businessy, low-class businessy issues.
Excellent. Paul asks an excellent question. First, fundamentally, we have to ask, why are we not allowed to do these things at all? So take a look at Rashi. Rashi says, Garcina vein ochem behen de kulu perusha de kalas roshin. What's the concern? Kalas rosh. Generally, the way we translate kalas rosh is frivolity. Yeah, something like frivolity, lightheadedness. But Rashi explains, what do you mean by kalas rosh over here? Loshon kalas shemakilonosa. Anything that lightens, anything that treats the Beis HaKnesses more lightly than it should be. So this is the answer over here. I actually didn't bring the sefer with me. I was planning on actually coding it next week, but the Birchas Avraham has a piece in which he basically demonstrates that there's a machlokus between how Rashi and Rambam understand this Mishnah. The Rambam, when he codifies this and he lists what you're not allowed to do in a Beis HaKnesses, Mishum Kalas Rosh, he actually omits hespedim, eulogies. I think he codifies it elsewhere. They don't eulogize in the Beis HaKnesses, but for him, it's not because of Kalas Rosh, because like you said, Paul, there's a difference between everything else being mentioned and a eulogy, which is probably the furthest thing from frivolity possible. I mean, this will happen sometimes where the Mishnah will just list a number of things that you can't do, but they might have different reasons behind why you don't do them. Okay, so let's move on to the Gemara. The Gemara is going to cite a price that elaborates.
We don't hold that today as far as in the Beit Knesset that you can't eat or drink under certain conditions or circumstances, I should say, like to have a kiddush there or to have a party or to celebrate a moed.
Between, you know, what we call the shul building versus the Beis HaKnesses. Again, I wasn't around when the folks from our, was anyone around when our current building was initially made the first time around? Okay, so I wasn't there either. I probably wasn't alive. when was our building first made? The current one. Anyone know?
Okay. I don't know.
Before
1963, I think.
What?
I think 1963.
It definitely precedes me by quite a few years. So anyway, I certainly was not there when they made it. So I don't know what was stipulated. But let's say in theory that the main sanctuary in our shul is a Beis HaKnesses. It might not be the case. We're going to talk about at the end of the Gemara today that you can make stipulations not to make it a Beis HaKnesses. The social hall is still not a Beis HaKnesses. The simcha room is not a Beis HaKnesses. The lobby is not a Beis HaKnesses. Now, they should still be, of course, treated with a certain level of dignity and decorum, but not because they're a Beis HaKnesses. Building the shul, not every room is a Beis HaKnesses. So, and by the way, I've never seen people permissibly bring food into the sanctuary. I think we're actually pretty careful about now there are kids who sometimes go against the rules and do that, but I'm pretty sure we never have. During my tenure, I've never seen a program where we actually programmatically bring food into the main sanctuary.
Not the main sanctuary, but we'll do it in the chapel.
Right,
yeah, for sure.
So we're going to talk about the chapel might be more of a multi-purpose room. So, okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. The Gemara is literally going to address this, actually. So excellent questions. Give me 2 minutes, and I think the Gemara is going to address your point, okay? So let's get into the Gemara. The Gemara cites a brisa, Tana Rabbanan, Batei Knesios Einog Ben Kalas Rosh. This brisa is talking about operational Batei Knesios right now. So Batei Knesios Einog Ben Kalas Rosh. One cannot... one should not be nohig any form of kalas rosh. Again, we'll just translate as quality for now. Or just anything that's not dignified for the Beis HaKnesses. Ein ochem hem ein shosim b'hem. We don't eat and drink. Now, again, you could ask the following shaila, wait a minute, eating and drinking to live might even be a mitzvah. That's what the Birchas Avraham asks. So he says, look again at Rashi, what does kalas mean? Shemakilon, yes. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with eating and drinking. In fact, there might be a value to eat and drink so you can live to serve God. But, you know, it's not a cafeteria still. You know, it's the same way, I mean, you'll forgive me, that one needs to use the restroom. But clearly, the shul's, the sanctuary is not the place where one relieves themselves. So one needs to eat and drink, but it doesn't mean you're supposed to be eating and drinking inside the sanctuary. The ain't shosim. Okay, fine. So you don't drink there. Turning the amen. And you don't go into the sanctuary and start adjusting your necklaces and jewelry and everything. You don't gallivant around the Beis HaKnesses.
Tell some of the young men in the sanctuary that who'd like walk around like, you know, it's just, you know. Take a look around.
All right. I have enough to worry about with the chapel, but I'll take a look at the sanctuary as well. If I don't have my hands full already. David Tyne, So that, you don't go to the Beis HaKnesses to hang out. It's like funny how like the Kosel, which has a, probably has a status in the Beis HaKnesses, people like go out to meet up and hang out at the Kosel. It's kind of funny. You're not even supposed to enter into a Beis HaKnesses to seek refuge from the sun or from the rain. Now, we'll talk about there's a way to circumvent that. You could come into the Beis HaKnesses and, you know, say Ashrei and, you know, say some Tehillim or, you know, learn some Torah, and then you came in for a purpose. Happens to me, you also reap the benefits of finding shade or shelter from the rain, but you didn't just walk in, stop. The Emasidin Bahen Hespet Shal Yachin, and one cannot give a eulogy of an individual there. Of a Korban Mishon Bahen, but we can read Torah there. That's what we're supposed to do. We can teach Gemara over there. Masidin Bahen Hespet Shal Ram, we can give a eulogy of the masses. Now, this doesn't mean that, God forbid, many people died at one time. What it means is, if you look at Rashi, Shel Talmud Chacham, of a Torah scholar, because since this is considered a loss for the entire community, therefore the eulogy should be held in the Beis HaKnesses, because the entire community will be coming to mourn their collective loss. All right, Yehuda, Amasai, Yeshuvan, Av B'chorbanam, Manich Masav Omen, Asav Lo Yitosh Bnei Agmas Nevesh. Then jumps in Rabbi Yehuda and says exactly what we said at the end of the Mishnah, and if grass begins to grow, you let the grass grow. Because people should feel anguish. The Gemara interjects, Asavim Man Dekar Shmaya, Rabbi Huda, that was a non sequitur. We're not talking about grass over here. What are you saying, Rabbi Huda? So the Gemara fills in that there may have been a few words missing from the Braisa. We have to insert a few words manually. Concerning Maxim Haki Gitani, read the Braisa as follows. You're supposed to sweep up the place and mop up and sprinkle some water, make sure that there's no dust lying around. In order so the grass doesn't grow. Rabbi Huda, now Rabbi Huda jumps in. Amasai, Yeshuvan. This is referring to when are you supposed to make sure grass doesn't grow in the shul? When people are using it. But when it's laid barren, it's no longer in operation. Manigno san lalos. So you're supposed to let the grass grow. That way the grass will be alu, will grow, and people will feel agmas nefesh by seeing their beautiful shul in shambles. Final point. This gets to what Phyllis and what Toby were saying. The shuls in Bavel, notice how it says in Bavel, this might be something unique to the diaspora. The Beis HaKnesses that are made in Bavel were made with a stipulation. Bavel Pekin, Enog Makalasorsh, meaning they were used for davening, but they're not limited for the purpose of davening. However, even though these pieces are permitted to be used for purposes other than davening, you still can't do something that would constitute Kalas Rosh. That would be disrespectful to a place that is sometimes used for davening. Amai Nihu, now what would you think that might be? Apparently, Cheshbonos. Apparently, people coming in and, doing stock trading and stuff would not be respectful to the environment of the shul. Go figure. All right, Asi. Beis HaKnesses Shemachashbo Cheshbonos Malinim Bo Es Hametz. Any shul that they do accountings, they count up money inside that shul, they should put a cadaver, they should put a dead body in there. Malina and Sagadaita, Losai Bav Haki, wait, why are we putting a dead body in a shul just because people are not treating it the right way? This is what he means to say. What's going to happen is, as retribution for mistreating the shul, ultimately you will come to find that there will be a mace mitzvah. There will be a dead body found in there, and it will be your responsibility to bury it on account of mistreating the Beis HaKnesses. Which, wow, that's quite a threat over there. It sounds like the gangsters are on them. Paul?
Yeah, another question. What's the status halachically of... You know, all these tours of old synagogues in Eastern Europe and in, you know, Turkey, you know, they're tourist sites at this point. But they're shuls. They were shuls.
Yeah. It's an excellent question, Paul. I never thought about that, I guess, because I don't go touring frequently enough. But I have been to a number of schools in Israel, which, like what you describe, are no longer in operation, but are tourist sites. I would guess if you do it the right way, a few shiur ago, we talked about how you could sell a shul with the Shiva Tovei Ha'ir, or even without the trustees, and the Kedusha would be transferred onto the funds, or would just dissipate altogether. So, if the shul was sold, then you could actually revoke its status as a Beis HaKnesses. Now, did the folks who were entrusted with the shul do it according to halacha? I would certainly hope they did. If you personally are concerned, just say Ashrei when you go in, and that will justify your entrance coming into the Beis HaKnesses. We had to do this, by the way, during earlier COVID. It was actually my second week over here, my second week here on the job. And I think Rabbi Cohen was going away for an occasion, and Rabbi Weissman from the Base of America came in order to facilitate two gittin that were done. And so we were on the patio where the sukkah usually is during the summer, and the whole, the chapel lobby, that whole area was in shambles. It was being reconstructed, so we couldn't get through the main entrance, and we couldn't go through that hallway either where the social is. Everything was blocked off, so you basically had to go through the main sanctuary down where the library was in order to, in order to get into the building for what we needed. So, that's what we did. We said Ashrei for a moment. We stood, said Ashrei, then you go down and you can pass through. That way you're not using the Beis HaKnesses as a kapadria, as a shortcut. Okay. I guess we'll open up next time with this idea. I want to talk about Shtiblach. Because Shtiblach, by the Hasidim, they do a lot more than just daven over there. And arguably there could be some kalas rosh. We'll talk about that at the beginning of next year, God willing. But I'd be remiss if I didn't share the following. As I was telling Henry, who's our resident Chicago attendee here this year, there is a special volume of Hadarim Journal that came out. It's now defunct, the journal, but they made a special volume to honor Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Zichrono Livracha. And he was the Av Beis Din of the Chicago Rabbinical Council's court in Chicago. And he put out a special volume in his honor. And the beginning of the volume actually has a number of responsa, tshuvos, that he wrote. I literally just got this a day or two ago. The RCA, Rabbinical Council of America, sent it out to all of its members. And I was literally just flipping through it today, and I came by a tshuva that's actually relevant to our shir. The tshuva is b'inyan hespid b'beis HaKnesses, whether a eulogy can be given inside a Beis HaKnesses. Literally our topic. It was sent to him from a Rabbi Yitzchak Nadav.
Nadav. He was a rabbi in Omaha for many years in the 1950s through 1990s. Isaac Nadav.
Okay, very good. It says Omaha, Nebraska. So that part I got. So the question basically was that they didn't have really a good funeral chapel in the neighborhood. People were uncomfortable with it. It wasn't in a good part of town, it seems from the description. Whatever the reason was, they wanted to hold the hespe, and they wanted to hold funerals at shul. I'm going to shorten the tshuva. The tshuva is actually not that long to begin with, but I'll just narrow it down for you. We literally just saw in the Mishnah and Gemara that we read that you're not supposed to have eulogies in the Beis HaKnesses for the common person. So how can you do that inside the sanctuary of a shul? Assuming, it's all assuming that the sanctuary has an actual status of a Beis HaKnesses. I think it's fair to assume a main sanctuary does, unless there's a stipulation. So there's basically two issues he identifies. Issue number one, there's one issue with bringing a deceased person into the Beis HaKnesses. And there's a separate but related issue of eulogizing the Beis HaKnesses. And basically what he says, based on the Shulchan Aruch and Orach Chaim, Sif Kufin and Av Sif Kata, if you look at, I think he's referencing Mishnah Berurah over there, Sif Kata Yud Aleph. So if you look over there, it basically he paskins, Debati Knesios B'chutzars, when it comes to shuls in the diaspora, because remember, we're talking about the shuls in Bavel, in diaspora, Mahani T'nai L'shtamishbo, Afilu B'yeshuvo, in Eivazah Hashimish Kalas Rosh. It's permissible to stipulate that such a place would be used for other purposes, provided, Paul, back to your point, it's not callous roche. It's not frivolous. A funeral service is the furthest thing you get from frivolity. So it would be okay to have the funeral service, he said. However, the mace should not be inside the Beis HaKnesses, as was his psak, because there were two issues. One is having the mace inside the Beis HaKnesses. The second was eulogizing. So he thought, he says, in Kain Lepizeb, Nida Din Don, Kev the Havi Shasad Chak, Bein Hesbe Bechal Kalas Rosh, Nir Diachoma Hasbe Beis HaKnesses, in Lomach Nisen, as Hamase Beis HaKnesses, Makon Tfila. His psak was to not bring the mace into the sanctuary, but the eulogy could be done in the sanctuary, provided that the shul was stipulated to be used for other purposes, and of course, understanding that his spadim are the furthest thing you get from Kalas Rosh, if you assume the term Kalas Rosh is translated as frivolity, which I think is the pashtus. Not like Rashi said, but I think that's the pashtus.
What's the problem with bringing the mace into the Beis Knesset other than the Kohanim?
Other than the Kohanim, I forgot precisely how he derives it. He bases this. Unless was, did we see in the Gemara itself? No, it didn't. Let's say I forget precisely where he's deriving it from. I have to look back at the tube. I didn't underline that part. But anyway, I'm sure there are other chuvos on this topic. I'm sure he's not the first to the party, but I just thought it was really great timing that I saw that chuva from him, and we were giving that chuva tonight, so I thought I would share it with you. All right, God willing, next time, if you hold me to it, we'll talk about whether Shtiblach can do all their fun parties in there, even though it's supposedly Makom Tfila. Oh, yeah, I'll just tell you. The short answer is, as we just answered, Shtiblach are not established as a Makom Tfila. The tefillah aspect is a secondary afterthought, which is kind of a funny way to think about it. What does that mean halachically? Well, halachically, it is ideal if I could pray in my home. Like, let's say I miss a minyan, okay? But I have the option to daven, even be a chidus on my own, in shul or in my house. It's better to daven in the Beis HaKnesses, in the shul, rather than daven at home, because the place itself has inherent sanctity to it. So what does this mean? Well, if the whole reason that a shtiebel, they can have all their fun parties in there, is because it's not a base tefillah, it's a base something, it's called a base chassidim, it's a place for chassidim to hang out, it's a place where people hang out with each other, and they happen to daven, it would actually be religiously preferable to daven at a shul with this Beis HaKnesses, which is a place that's actually a makom tefillah that's designated first and foremost for tefillah. Now, the thing is, there's different kinds of shtiblach out there. Like, sometimes what we call shtiblach just means a small little shul with a clique that runs it. It might actually be primarily a Beis tefillah. But one last thing I'll share with you. I didn't get to look at the tshuva inside, but really amusing point that supposedly the Radvaz says, just with the, again, the qualification, I didn't get to look it up directly. The tshuva is in Chelek Gimel Siman Tuf Ayin Beis. That the Ravaz says that if we look in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Yitzman Av, it says, "Ein adam lomei Torah el b'magom shlibo chafetz." That people learn Torah the best when they're learning from somewhere that they desire. If I really enjoy learning a particular area of Torah, that's the area of Torah I'm going to learn best because I'm intrinsically motivated to study it. So based on this principle in Avodah Zarah, the Ravaz says, "Kein hu adin hu atam the mitzvah tefillah." Same principle could be extrapolated from Torah study to prayer. Hibit adam al svivaso the krova v'avav the rabosav. When a person looks around and he sees his buddies and he sees the rabbis, v'amisha datu nochmehem, and people who he's at ease with. So then, tisporah nashim biyosa kavana shlema, it will enable him to have better kavana during davening. Well, hatzalav ruach mimarom, and in order to bring down a very, a spiritual mindset when davening. I don't know what to make of this Ravaz, because usually it's the opposite. Usually, it's like the people you daven with that you can't, the people you're friends with you can't daven with, How's it saying go? So I don't, I guess the Ravaz must have just been on like a really holy level that even when he was davening with his buddies, it somehow gave him more kavana because they were all just like really awesome people who had great kavana. I'm not sure how much we can extrapolate from Ravaz to others, but anyway, do with that source what you will. Okay, God willing, we will pick up Chavkas Amad Beis, and I owe you guys an email. I think the last Sunday in February is when we're going to plan to do the CM, when Marina returns from South America as our head
she's
of the
bad.
Well,
she's
well, giving, right. I'm just giving her a little bit of time to breathe. I'm going to discuss with her just because she's ahead of adult ed, just how we're going to envision this.
Rabbi, when my father passed away, the rabbi certainly would not bring the mace into the shul, but they opened all the doors of the shul. And the rabbi said a few words, and then they proceeded with my father and everybody to the cemetery. But there's a whole long list of cars, and the doors were wide open. And that's how they, I guess that's the way they did it.
And that makes sense. I think what you're describing is in accordance with what Rav Schwartz posked. So thank you for sharing that with us, Glory. Thank you. All right. Well, it's good learning with all of you. We're at the end of our time for this evening. Wishing you all a wonderful Shabbos. I'm looking forward to learning together next week. Best of
Shabbos.
Henry, good
Shabbos.
Henry,
good Shabbos.
Yes.
I know that you. I know that Chicago is a big place. But do you know the Gardner family?
Gardner.